Matt Dillon has been playing leading roles in movies since he was 16. Known in his early years as a teen idol, he's now 42 and can look back on a career of diverse and challenging roles. He played a heroin addict and thief in Drugstore Cowboy, a dishonest private detective on the make in There's Something About Mary, and a racist cop in the movie Crash, a role which earned him an Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actor. His other films include My Bodyguard, The Outsiders, To Die For, and this summer's You, Me, and Dupree. In 2002, he co-wrote and directed the film City of Ghosts. Dillon is currently starring in Factotum, based on the novel by Charles Bukowski, the late L.A. writer known for his confessional and painfully realistic style. Dillon's character, Henry Chinaski, is widely regarded as Bukowski's alter ego. He's an alcoholic who moves through menial jobs and failed relationships while pursuing his quest to become a published writer. In this scene from Factotum, Chinaski reflects on the challenges of writing, then interviews for a job in a pickle factory.
As we live, we all get caught and torn by various traps. Writing can trap you. Some writers tend to write what has pleased their readers in the past. They hear accolades and believe them. There is only one final judge of writing, and that is the writer. When he is swayed by the critics, the editors, the publishers, the readers, then he's finished. And of course, when he's swayed with his fame and his fortune, you can float him down the river with the turds.
A writer, huh?
Yes.
Are you sure?
No, I'm not.
Why do you want to work in a pickle factory?
It reminds me of my grandmother.
It does?
She used to serve me pickles whenever I visited her.
What do you write?
Mostly short stories. I'm halfway through a novel.
What's it about?
Everything.
You mean, for instance, it's about cancer?
Yes.
How about my wife?
She's in there, too.
Well, Matt Dillon, welcome to Fresh Air. In this new film, Factotum, you play this character, Hank Chinaski, from the Charles Bukowski novel. A guy you wouldn't want your daughter to date, probably. I mean, he drinks too much. He drifts from job to job. He has these casual relationships. And yet there's kind of something maybe deeper going on in his head. Tell us about this character and how you got into the role.
Well, for me, I guess it all starts with, my background with Charles Bukowski is that I read most of his novels and short stories when I was in my early 20s, and then I put them down, and I hadn't really thought much about Bukowski for some years, and then all these years later, the producer of Factotum and the director, Bent Hammer, approached me about playing Chinaski in Factotum, and my first reaction was like surprised, but I just didn't feel like something that I could do, and you know that certainly Bukowski is a different physical type than myself, and I always thought of him as an older. This is the same guy who wrote Notes of a Dirty Old Man, mm-hmm. and he achieved success so late in the game that I often, I just thought of him as an older guy. And then they reminded me, look, you're really at the right age to play Chinaski during that period that chronicled Charles Bukowski, those early years when he was trying to get published as a poet. And once it was established that they weren't looking for me to do an impersonation of Charles Bukowski, which would have been a disaster, then I knew that I could do it.
You spoke to Bukowski's widow to get ready for this. What did you get from that experience?
You know, one of the things she told me was that there's this kind of misconception or this idea about Charles Bukowski that he was dirty, that he was a slob, that he wasn't clean. And this was something that really, really bothered him because, in fact, he was the antithesis of that. He was very neat and very clean and very disciplined. And that's something that really gave me some insight into Chinaski's dignity, you know, that this is something that, you know, that he had, you know, he had this sort of pride that he would keep himself neat, that he would, you know, that, you know, one of the things the director did, Ben Tamer, was he put in a sequence where you see Hank washing his clothes and hanging them up. And
right, and that in a cheap room where he does it on a sink, actually, right?
Yeah, he washes them in a sink and he hangs them up before he sits down to write. And for me, that really, you know, that really, those little touches were really important to sort of play against what, you know, and the natural instinct for an actor is if you're going to play, you know, a bum on Skid Row is to, like, you know, who ends up homeless, to get down into the gutter and rub your face in it. And, you know, and this, she gave me these sort of insights that were really helpful.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you see Henry Chinaski, you in this film, you know, drinking, getting fired, going through these casual relationships. But we see the other side of the character often through these internal monologues that appear in the film as voiceovers, and the, you know, our audience just heard one in the clip that we played earlier. What was the frame of mind you pictured for that character when you were doing those voiceovers? I wondered at times if you were slurring your words just a bit, as if you had been drinking. What was in your head when you were doing those?
You know, for one thing, I really tried to avoid playing drunk, just more allowing it to happen in the way that it naturally would. For one thing, he's a maintenance drinker, you know. It's not like he's not this like happy-go-lucky kind of Arthur drunk, you know, like from the movie Arthur. Or
right,
you know?
Not falling down over the piano, right?
Yeah, exactly. So there's that, you know. It's like he's drinking all the time, more or less, and so you know, there's that part of it. We did the voiceover stuff before we began shooting, and then we did some of it again afterwards, And I, as an actor, I can tell the stuff I did beforehand and the stuff I did afterwards, but that's a whole other thing. I think the idea was that that would be the stuff that was going on that he was writing at the time, the stuff that, you know, that he was observing around him. And so I think that's what that represented for him. I tried not to be too slurry, but there's a kind of – that was one of the challenges for me because – you know, I listened to a lot of Bukowski doing poetry readings, and I think it was something he really didn't take a lot of pleasure in doing. I don't think he liked doing readings. And so I think there was a guarded quality to his readings, you know. That's what I picked up, that there was this kind of affectation in a way. And he had a sing-song quality, which I kind of liked. It sort of went against what... When I read Bukowski, I always imagined this gruff voice that sounded more like, you know, Warren Oates or, you know, Lee Marvin or something. But in fact, he has kind of a sing-song, almost at times effeminate sound, you know, to his voice. So for me, I wanted to kind of combine, well, who he really was and his real delivery and his mannerisms with those of Chinaski, the alter ego that he had created, if I could combine the two of them, because I do believe that Chinaski was sort of a sort of idealized version of himself in a way.
Do you want to say a little bit about playing these scenes where you and Lily Taylor have to play a couple that's kind of maintaining a relationship, sort of, you know, on the edge of employment and on the on the edge of connection to one another? I mean, it's a pretty troubled relationship.
It's interesting because in a lot of ways, the film is a love story, you know, and, you know, these are characters that are pretty much set in their ways. And, you know, there's a lot of talk in film about, you know, character arc, character development, and often, you know, in films like in Crash, for example, this film that I did where a lot of the characters, they have this arc where they come to this realization of who they are, and there's some sort of epiphany or this change that comes over them. And, you know, that's not the case. You know, I think that's like the core of what's happening, say, in Crash, these moments, you know. But that's not the case in Factotum. Factotum, these people are pretty much who they are. You know, I think you basically have these two characters who are people that are sort of set in their ways. But I think as a viewer, you discover more about them as you go along and the way that they interact with each other. Because the two people that really, I mean, in reality, Jan, the character of Jan, who Lily plays, in real life, she was a woman named Jane. And that was the only woman that Bukowski ever sort of admitted to really having been in love with. But they seem to be two kind of doomed people. Like, they couldn't stay away from each other, but they couldn't stand each other. And in the end, they just seem to always be drifting away from each other, but kind of coming back. And I think there's something kind of human about that. I think a lot of us have been in relationships like that. It's never that clean. The break isn't. Our emotions don't break away that freely.
My guest is Matt Dillon. He is appearing in the new film, Factotum. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining me, my guest is Matt Dillon. He is appearing in the new film, Factotum. You know, most people with a 25-year Hollywood career have a lot more gray hair than you do, and I'm sure you've been asked for decades about what it was like to get into the business so early. But I have to ask you, is the legend true that you were discovered by a casting director for this film when you were cutting class at age 14?
Yeah. I mean, it always sounds strange to say discovered. Nobody likes to say they were discovered. You know, it just sounds, a little bit weird. But yeah, I was like, I guess you could say that that's more or less what happened. I mean, I was in junior high school and there were like 10 kids from my junior high school who were sort of brought down to audition for this film that was being made. But they were looking for, instead of using professional actors, they were looking for 14 and 15-year-old kids that were, were real kids, So, in the beginning, I thought, well, wow, this is going to be great. I'll be in a movie. And then I found out there were thousands of kids who had auditioned for it. And some of them were like professionals who'd been in like the Bad News Bears and stuff. And I thought, well, I don't stand a chance against these guys. They're pros.
And you were in this film, Over the Edge.
Over the Edge. I was Over the Edge.
And then you get these, you appear in My Bodyguard playing the bully. And you're in these two great Francis Ford Coppola films, mm-hmm. Rumblefish and The Outsiders. And then, at a really early age, you've got this huge leading man teen idol thing going. You were here at an age when most kids, are worrying about band practice and acne treatments. And you've got this huge thing happening. And there are stories of like Roger Ebert interviewing you. It's at age 18, 19. And I can't help but think, looking back now that you've got a little more maturity in years, do you ever look back and just wonder how you processed all that huge stuff and happening in your life?
Well,
or was it just a blast?
No, it was fun. But I mean, there were things that I remember that I look back at, like meeting Shelley Winters when I was 14 years old and Schwab's. And I remember there was something, I think there were certain principles, like some of the people that I was around early on in my career. For some reason, it seemed like I was surrounded by people who were affected by the blacklist. They were either red diaper babies, their parents were blacklisted, or they themselves were blacklisted. They were married to somebody that was my acting teacher, my first director, the writer of the first film, Tim Hunt or Jonathan Kaplan. And the thing about a lot of those people were Walter Bernstein. These people really had principles, And I think I was really lucky to be around people like that. And that coupled with the fact that, I happened to be fortunate enough to get around the right people when I started. And also I came from a pretty good family background. I didn't immediately, once I started acting, go to a professional, a school for teenage actors or something. So I had this kind of dual thing going on. I was growing up and, in the suburbs, hanging out with my friends, doing all that kind of stuff. Some of it was getting in trouble. Some of it was, was just whatever kids do. And then there was this part of me who was going down to studying at the Lee Strasberg Institute and going to auditions and going to premieres of films and doing stuff like that.
In 2002, you directed the film, I guess co-wrote and directed the film City of Ghosts. Mm. It's sort of a story of intrigue and duplicity. You're the central character, Jimmy, sort of in a point reevaluating your life. And this is after you've been questioned by the FBI in an insurance scam in New York. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the film is actually set in Cambodia. Why Cambodia?
I'll tell you, I visited Cambodia in about 1993 with a friend of mine, a childhood friend I'd grown up with who was studying in Japan. And it wasn't, I hadn't planned on going, you know, I was on my way to Vietnam to, you know, I was in Thailand and I was almost going to be traveling around Southeast Asia. And it was suggested that, hey, you ought to go to visit Angkor Wat and see Cambodia while you still can, because the UN is there, so there is a degree of stability, you know. But that might not stick, you know. And so when I got there, I was taken with the country. There was something very cinematic about it and beautiful and also kind of dangerous and on the verge of a dramatic transition itself. And for whatever reason, it just stayed with me. And there was also something very sort of totally atmospheric. And there was it had a fairy tale like quality to me. The city of Phnom Penh with its beautiful stupas and the palace, the royal palace and the pagodas and along the Mekong River. And then there was this sort of, at the time, darkened streets, and there was a sense of kind of foreboding there as well. And it just stayed with me. And it wasn't until a couple of years later that I decided that I wanted to write a film that was set there. And it was based on some of the people that I had met in my travels in Southeast Asia during that couple of months when I was over there, and some of the things that I witnessed. And that was the basis for this film. To me, it was always going to be set in Cambodia. I mean, it really was always one of the characters of the film. And the atmosphere was every bit as important to me as the structure and the plot.
One of the moments in this film, which I just love, is a bizarre evening where there's James Caan, the mentor, the kind of the leader of the scam artists, is at this nightclub. And there's sort of this menacing situation. And he does a karaoke song singing in Khmer. Where did that come from?
Well, to me, that's one of the magic moments of having made that film, you know, for me, was when Barry and I were writing that scene. We wrote, okay, and at that point, Marvin puts his head back, closes his eyes, and begins to sing in fluent Khmer. And I liked the way it sounded. And, of course, in my mind, I thought, well, depending on what actor we get to play Marvin, we can always change it to a Tony Bennett song if it has to be, or whatever it has to be, you know. And, of course, then I said that to James Caan. I said, look, if you're uncomfortable learning to sing this in Khmer, he says, Matt, why do you think I took the friggin' job? You know, so Jimmy embraced it wholeheartedly. He's an intrepid actor, and that's what he did. And he's actually the talented singer. When we were sitting there and I was watching it, I was mesmerized. I had to pinch myself to see that I was watching this. And one of the Cambodian actors turned to me, who was not really an actor, but he was stunned. He said, his accent is perfect. He's fluent. He sounds like a Khmer. So that was a great moment for me to be able to watch Jimmy do that.
Well, we'll be watching to see what you come up with next. Matt Dillon, thanks so much for talking with us.
Okay.
Matt Dillon. He stars in the new film Factotum. It opens next week.